ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Artemis 2 is go, the first human mission to the moon in more than 50 years. And we are following every step of the journey, from lunar flyby to splashdown, in a special daily season of science fiction called Artemis Explained. Join me, Belinda Smith, for mission updates so you know what's happening and why it matters. It's Artemis Explained. Search for science fiction on ABC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello and welcome to ABC Radio National's The Bookshelf. I'm Kate Evans.
And I'm Cassie McCullough. And books, 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 that's what we're talking about. We're revisiting the Trojan War. It's still going in some parts of the world, I think. In fact, it may be reigniting. In Jan Martel's Son of Nobody.
And a heartfelt story of friendship and loss in Deborah Adelaide's When I Am 64.
And a rather racy excursion into queer Sydney in the 1940s in Fiona Kelly McGregor's The Trap.
And to take us straight into these stories today, let's meet our reviewers.
Well, Hannah Kent is with us, novelist, screenwriter, memoirist, whose books include Burial Rites, Devotion and Always Home, Always Homesick. And so too is Tom Wright, theatre writer and adapter, artistic associate at Belvoir Theatre. Hello to you both.
Hello, hello.
Well, hello. Good to be back on the shelf.
Hello. Now, we're going to begin with the latest from Fiona Kelly McGregor, who's written essays, art history and experimental genre-busting work as well as fiction. Her books include Strange Museums, Suck My Toes, Dirt and Indelible Ink.
Yes, and more recently, Iris, which was a really extraordinary portrait of a real woman, Iris Webber, who was a Sydneysider in the early half of the 20th century, living by her wits, sometimes on the streets. She had a little melodeon or a kind of accordion that she'd busk with and do, was it tap dancing, I think? She also worked as a sex worker. And I think we all kind of really liked that book because it showed the harshness of Sydney at that time. Tom?
Yes, I remember speaking about it on the shelf at the time and it felt like a breath of fresh air and a very interesting shining of light into a previously dark corner.
I really like the way that fiction like this, when you live in the city that it's written about, makes you sort of retrace histories and geographies. And so it took us into the slums and the underworld of Sydney in the 1930s. Hannah Kent, you read it as well.
I did, yeah. I remember thinking it was just the most incredibly evocative rendering of Sydney during that time that I'd ever stumbled across. And I think she did an incredible job really conveying a lot of the small details of what it was. So, you know, I could really imagine like the smelly armpits and sort of the damp clothes. And I don't even know if she wrote about that, but that's what I was sort of seeing and almost smelling. It was this very sort of, you know, sensory experience reading that book. But yeah, incredible work in developing that backdrop and then having the narrative play out against it. I found it hugely compelling.
Yes, and one of the key elements of that story was Iris's sexuality and her life, not only as a sex worker, but as a lesbian in Sydney and in the queer scene, which from the account that Fiona Kelly McGregor has dug up from the archives, seems like it was a rollicking time. I mean, there's a brilliant scene in that book in a nightclub where you have to know it's on for a start, and then you have to know how to get there, and then you have to be cool enough, really. That was one of the standouts of that book, this nightclub scene. And Tom, I think in this new book, which is called The Trap, we learn more about that nightclub and indeed the guys who ran it.
Indeed, we pick up where we left off. The Trap is formidably good. I'm just going to start at that. This is a pickup. Everything that we loved about Iris, this is Iris turned up. And we start at the Black Adders, which is an almost legendary, almost mythic club in Sydney queer history. It was run by the legendary Black Adder, and they came from shadowy background, shall we say. And Fiona Kelly McGregor starts her long epic saga of queer and racial identity in Sydney in the Blackadders nightclub era, just after it shut down. So Blackadders was a dance hall, dance club in the sort of Surrey Hills region of Sydney. In The Trap, we start in 1942. So we're in the middle of the war. The Japanese have just been invading the harbour. There's a sense of insecurity. And a character called Ray Sales, or also known as Roy Pierce, black, Australian, from the Northern Rivers part of New South Wales, working class, transgressive, queer, almost 99% sure to be the eponymous Blackadder, is trying to make a living. And so we're taken instantly within three pages. Anybody who's read Iris or anybody who hasn't knows we're in very sure hands. This is an author who knows Sydney, who knows the Australian idiom, but also understands the delicate nuance of the intersections of queerness, of race, of the way gender works, of the politics of having Americans in the city. And here we are, immersed suddenly in a world which is very dangerous anyway. The entire society is imperiled, and Fiona Kelly McGregor hones in on the people who are the most vulnerable: Indigenous people, queer people, black people, surviving with wit and aplomb in a darkened, well, a browned out Sydney. We're suddenly in that territory, and you're led to believe that we're going to follow the story of Ray Sales and the story, just as we had with Iris. But no, Fiona Kelly McGregor has bitten off a considerable amount more with this novel, and we go on a big journey.
Yeah, she's got big plans for us. Yeah, Ray's this sort of preening dresser and a repressed flaneur, because he has to keep it toned down when he's out on the street.
Well, imagine being a black queer man in Sydney in the war, and you know, he wears his zoot suit. He's clearly got a lot of charm and charisma, but the toughness.
Yeah, but the black American soldiers, actually sailors who are in town, who we filled the streets of King's Cross and the inner east and the inner west of Sydney during that time, actually provide a little bit of cover for Ray and his brother Henry. They're two guys who grew up together. It's not actually sure what their background, their racial background is. And later on, we learn that they may only be half brothers or maybe only step brothers. It's all kind of a little unclear. But yes, you're right. We're back on the streets of Sydney, and we're out of the Depression era of Iris. This is a kind of strange boomtown, because the Americans are filling the streets and the pubs and these illegal nightclubs, and they're cashed up, at least as far as the locals are concerned, because they're keen to siphon off as much of those juicy military pay packets as they can after all those hungry years. So, you know, there's a bit of thrill on. But as you say, this is one of five sections in the book. We'll just sort of race ahead to the end of the first one, which is Brothers, which is about Ray and Henry. And Ray is picked up in a toilet and accused of an indecent act.
And this is the constant theme of the book and of this period of time. It's anybody who's an aficionado of Sydney at this period knows that there were particular beats, one of which was most famous was on Churchill, called Lang Park, which was famous for where police would lie in wait and would trap men who they believed had gone in there for so-called perverted practices. We're introduced to it through Ray, but it unfurls, and we realise it's not just the underclass that are being picked on by the police. There are a couple of errant police officers who are building up their cases, and they're not discriminating who they're prepared to collar for indecent exposure.
Yeah, so in this next section, which is called Cops, we meet Carney and Grig, who are these low-ring coppers at the number 4 police office, which is somewhere down on Phillip Street in Sydney. Carney's from the Monaro. His father was a grazier, but he joined the force in Sydney just before the crash. And he sort of feels a little bit secure because he's got, you know, tenure there, but also thwarted because he's a Catholic.
Yeah.
And apparently most cops then were either Protestant or Freemason.
Certainly the officers.
Yeah, right. And Grig is his offsider, who's very good looking. And together they come up with this, well, thing, this procedure, that's probably what we'd call the trap of the title, and that is that Grieg would go down into the toilet at the urinal and sort of sidle up to a guy who came in, and then Carney would come in on the other side, and as soon as the guy either accepted or seemed to accept the invitation that Grieg had extended, then Carney would pounce and arrest him. So, you know, there's a procession of pastors and out-of-town working men or married men or whatever, you know.
David Jones window dressers and a whole array of people. But
who fall into their clutches.
But then they choose the wrong person because they collar a member of Sir Frank Packer's editorial team, and straight away the intersection, and you've already mentioned about the way sectarian tensions were riven in the police force, but the class tension comes in at this point. We're less than 100 pages in, and Fiona Kelly McGregor has already given a picture of Australian society more sophisticated than many, many, many other novels of the era. You know, you read so many historical novels set in the war, and it just feels like 21st century people and their prejudices cosplaying the past. This has the whiff of authenticity that Hannah was talking about before, the smell of armpits. You can almost smell the urinal and the cake soap in it and so on. I was completely taken in, and I just wanted to turn the pages and see how our author handles this, because these aren't invented characters. Every single name we've mentioned so far was a real person, and there is barely a made-up entity in this book. And we know how hard that is to do, to write a novel about historical figures. And Carney and the figures in the Packer's empire, the figures in the senior police force, these are all real men. And the prejudices that are on show and on display are very salutary for a contemporary reader.
And Tom and Cassie, this is also making me think about her research and the way in which any stories of an underworld and an underclass are also stories of cops and the legal system as well. And in Iris, there was a lot about early women members of the police force. And in this one, she's obviously moving ahead in time, but is she also making a decision about moving into the men's story in this one?
Which means, I guess so. One of those women does appear, actually. One of those female coppers is there. But this is, as Tom says, deeply immersed in the archive. And in a way, I have to say that the difficulty of historical fiction is exposition. Mm. I feel this could almost have been three novels. Each one could have been slowed down, expanded. I mean, I encourage her to make this a series of books about that time, because there's so much richness in it, and she's so deeply fascinated with it that you pick up her enthusiasm. But because there's so much to unload, tonally it can become rather monotonous and unrelenting and frantic in a way. You know, at one point we meet Marshall, McKay, McNulty, and then somebody else, you know, like then we've got to try and remember who they all are.
Cassie, that's what I appreciated about this book is that after Iris, which I felt suffered from that monotone you're talking about, there's a formal ambition to what Fiona Kelly McGregor is doing with this book. It's not just, as you said, it's divided into parts, but there are at least seven narrative voices that take us through the streets of Sydney. Sometimes literally in quite beautiful sections where we walk through the brownout streets. But
when you say brownout, we should just explain
almost a blackout.
Yes, it's just where the lights dimmed to save energy.
Yeah, wax paper over the windows and so on, and the trams with half light and all of that.
To stop the bombing.
But we've already mentioned Ray Sayles, the sort of the black dancer and, as he was described at the time, female impersonator. We've already mentioned or alluded to Lillian Armfield, the legendary women police sergeant and her later career, but we haven't even mentioned Hal Munro, who is a famous solicitor of the era, who also gets to speak as a sort of narrative voice, or the aforementioned Tom Carney, that police constable, the one who was involved in setting the trap, or Clarence McNulty, the editor, who is a sort of a urbane wannabe European, the victim of the trap.
Yeah, and also when Frank Packer sort of rolls over his wife, Gretel, to pick up this phone at 1:30 in the morning, the next calls he makes.
the most heavily legaled section of the novel.
Quite possibly. He ends up heading up to somewhere up Pittwater or the Hawkesbury to go and see McKay, the police commissioner, and they ended up going out, not only driving through bush, which it would have been at that point, you know, catching a little boat.
Well, and that, and drinking. This is the other thing that McGregor's so good at, is she explains that alcohol, the way alcohol was the absolute lubricant for truth and for lies of this society at the time. So, yes, we have a number of voices, and you can, on one level, it can be, as you say, Cassie, you can feel a little bit breathless. And I have to say, you don't read this book for the style. Sometimes the dialogue can feel a bit expositional, and sometimes you can think, structurally, this does feel a bit like unfiltered research. But the world building, if you're a reader who loves novels, which builds a three-dimensional world, McGregor is in complete control of this. And as a devotee of old Trove Australia and old newspapers, I can say this is like meeting old friends, and here they are again coming up to you and speaking to you in this form. And I was entranced by it.
Well, speaking is the key word. I mean, a lot of what we read is dialogue or reported speech. There's no quotation marks, speech marks anywhere. A lot of the sentences are short. There's barely a comma around. And if there is one, it's for forward motion to sort of almost list-like. And there's so much detail. There's a lot of action as well, which is excitingly done through speech. But as these details build up, I didn't know which ones to take note of and hold on to it, and what was completely extraneous. Like, there's a point where Ray wanders into Victoria Barracks, signs up, enlists, and then next thing he's in Holsworthy and he's met these three guys in the kitchen. One of them's really nice. He looks like Peter Lorre. And then in the next scene, he's run over by a truck and we never hear about him again.
No, we don't.
I'm like, where's the Peter Lorre guy, you know?
But the way I got my head around that, Cassie, was I thought of this as being Dickensian. This is a panoply of characters, historical characters, but painted as richly as a Dickensian casting list. And sometimes they do go down cul-de-sacs, and sometimes they do go down red herring pathways.
Yes,
and
but
it's all part
Dickens,
of
course, was writing in a different mode. He was writing episodically, and sometimes he needed people to come and go pretty quickly, whereas that's not really the mission of this.
No, this is race, gender, queerness, and there's a number of different stages and settings which have been laid out for these conversations to take place in. Mm-hmm. And I really appreciated the ability of an author to describe a Sydney of that era, which ranges from Potts Point and Darling Point, the most affluent suburbs, all the way down to the stews and rookeries of Surrow.
And Surrow being Surrow Hills,
that's the lingo.
See, we're in there.
That's the lingo that McGregor uses, Surrow, Darlow, all of the of the language of the time. And I think just the nightclubs that we started with talking about are again evoked, including the Booker T. Washington, which was a social club for African-American servicemen, also in Surrow, or the Judge Lane jazz sort of
bar. Well, they didn't have TV,
Tom, so they
had to really make their own. Now, Kate, you've got a question I can see because you've got your pencil out.
I know, I have my pencil and I'm pointing, which is probably a bit rude. Look, the other thing about all of those places where people were going and dancing and meeting up with visiting sailors, it made me think of Come In Spinner by Dimfina-Cusack and Florence James, where they're, which is a strongly class-based story of Australia, of Hotel Australia, of princes. And it, of course, was written in the period. But it almost feels like perhaps you could read these books from the period side by side with Trap and see how what she's doing is taking the stories that we're familiar with and inverting them and playing with them in a sort of satisfying way, expanding the bookshelf.
Well, like Caddy would be in there as well, perhaps.
Well, Carly Tennant's Favot is also very present in this, but I think this is the best thing about it that you've just described, Kate, is that it is like reading one of those books, but that new doors and new windows have been opened.
Yes, but what marks this and makes it particular is that Fiona Kelly McGregor likes to shock with her descriptions of sex, and that is a political act that she is taking. She's platforming gay and lesbian and queer sex, but she places it alongside this sort of brutal, transactional and sometimes violent or exploitative sexual activity, like some forms of beat sex, some forms of prostitution which come with violence. And actually, in the midst of all this, there's a Japanese pornographic photographic book haunting the story.
Prints,
and the people,
like block prints
and the people who see it. Is it block prints as well as photographs?
Mm.
And it's like this intrusive ghost that haunts whoever's seen it.
And it's not Japanese by accident.
Yeah, and so somehow this haunts, I think it's Carney. And also Carney's haunted by having witnessed a lot of these sex acts that he has seen in the toilets, and he begins to masturbate to them, goes to a priest goes to confession in his Catholic church. We then learn there has been some kind of incidents before. So, you know, she's also really investigating the sex of that era that is now something that we know how to talk about. But back then, no one knew how to talk about that.
They're aware. Iris and the other women in particular are very aware of the fluid nature and the transactional nature of what we've come to call sexuality. I think it's actually quite sophisticated the way this is dealt with. And that book you're referring to, the collection of Japanese images, the solicitor Hal Munro has in his drawer, and he's anxiously almost has to break into his own house to retrieve it because he's worried that his ex-wife will discover it. Every character is haunted by sexual practice in this book.
Yep.
And that is the fact that it's Japanese at a time when the entire society is
terrifying.
Under threat is very interesting.
Yeah. All right. Well, it sounds like a hit for you, Tom. I have some qualifications, but I think what she's doing...
It's a great read. It might not be a great book.
I think she does take the past and make it her own, and now she needs to take her own story and loosen that grip the past has on her.
And that book is The Trap by Fiona Kelly McGregor, published by Picador. This is ABC Radio National's weekly book review program and podcast, The Bookshelf, with me, Kate Evans, with Cassie McCullough, and our guests this week, theatre writer Tom Wright and novelist Hannah Kent. And next on our book pile, an elegant offering from Deborah Adelaide.
When I am 64, no Beatles abbreviation here, Kate, it's Australian writer and editor Deborah Adelaide's 18th book. She's got novels, short story collections, non-fiction, edited works to her name, including The Household Guide to Dying, The Innocent Reader, and Zebra, which we quite liked, I remember, Kate.
Mm.
Now, where does this one fit?
This new book, When I Am 64... there's many different ways of reading it, and I think that's part of what Hannah and I will be talking about. But she has this very useful note at the end of the book where she says, "This is a work of autofiction based on the real story of my friendship with Gabrielle Carey, but shaped with the tools of fiction and expressing truths that are uniquely mine." So she's calling it a novel. She's calling it autofiction, but it is possible to read it as memoir as well, because this is a book that's based on her decades-long friendship with the writer Gabrielle Carey, who died by suicide in 2023. But Gabrielle is not named in the book. And also I should say to people, Cassie, that we know discussions of mental health and suicide can be distressing for listeners. So a warning that that is where we're heading.
Now, of course, Gabrielle Carey was one half of the duo who produced one of Australia's most extraordinary books, and that is Puberty Blues, along with Kathy Lett.
The other thing that's worth noting is that in that period when Puberty Blues was written, Deborah Adelaide and Gabrielle Carey were already friends and they were at high school together. But Deborah was not part of the surf scene. She didn't have the same experience.
Are you saying she wasn't a slack-assed mole?
She's very clear that her parents would not have let her hang out at the beach like that. But all of that complicated history, Hannah Kent, feeds into this, it's not a very long book, but into a book that I called Elegant. How would you describe what's happening in this book?
It's an extraordinary book, and in some ways I wish that I had read more about it before I started reading. I was aware that Deborah Adelaide was friends with Gabrielle Carey, but when I started reading this book, I assumed it was memoir. And I remember I made a note to myself a few pages in saying, why isn't she naming her friend? Why is it simply the friend? And we also have the voice of this narrator. Why are we not being as explicit as perhaps, you know, she ought to be if this is the story of their friendship over the many years? And it wasn't actually until I had completed the book and read the author afterward and saw that she referred to it as order fiction that I was able to understand, I think, some of the aspects of the text that I think probably troubled me the most. And in fact, what then had annoyed me became things that I could reflect on and think, actually, that's a very clever way that she has done that. But I mean, this is an extraordinary book in many ways. One of the things that I love the most about it is the fact that it's self-aware. We begin with this beautiful scene of the person we can imagine is Deborah coming to the bedside of her friend. It's this gorgeous paragraph that I would actually love to read. She says,
please.
I would leave my airy house and drive to her cold, narrow one to find her with the sheets pulled up to her neck, the quilt smooth over the tiny lozenge of her frame. And so we are introduced to this friendship and to this friend within the context of sickness, within the context of one friend trying to aid another, but also within the context of intimacy. And I think the very specific intimacy that is shared by friends who have known each other for such a long time. And the next thing Deborah does is describe the bed that her friend is lying in. It's pan-made, it's been carved. And within the description of her friend ailing and, you know, being very troubled and having difficulty leaving the bed, she is reminded and then writes also of her other memories of that bed, which is largely she remembers when her friend would take her child when they were both young mothers and she would put them down to nap in this same place. And you see this then continue throughout the rest of the book, which is largely written in vignettes, in these very short, you know, in some ways quite fragmented combination of memories, which dissolve, I think, our conception of time. We go back and forth and back and forth, but over the course of the book, this builds into what I would probably describe as a portrait, more than memoir and probably more than a work of order fiction. I think that this is a portrait not necessarily just of the friend, of Gabrielle Carey, but also a portrait of a friendship and a portrait of its loss.
I love reading stuff about friendship. I think it is such an interesting relationship and it is so well done here because it includes the care, you know, turning up to say, let's go for a walk, let's get out of here. She helps make the house more welcoming. But there's also the sort of toughness that can come with long friendship when she can call out her friend on what at one point she describes as sentimental nonsense, or she'll say, what are you doing? Why are you doing this? And one of the really powerful things she says to her friend is, you can't do to them, meaning your daughter and grandchild, you can't do to them what your father did to you. And Gabrielle Carey's father died by suicide also at the age of 64. So this friendship is haunted by each other's families and by the intimacy that came from knowing each other so well. And Deborah, or the narrator character, was influenced by her friend's family, which was a family full of books and ideas and reading the newspaper and cutting holes in the newspaper in a way her family wasn't. Her family didn't have that way of looking outwards into the world. And there's something both terribly moving about hearing about this friendship and family, but tragic that it referred back to her friend's father like that.
I think this is one of the clever things that it does, is that, yes, it is essentially about these two women, but so many other people are brought in and discussed in their lives. And it becomes sort of a contemplation of the ways in which our lives are connected and the trauma that can be inflicted when those connections, you know, whether formal or whether deeply personal, are broken. And I feel like that is a real theme within the book. But you're right, I thought, you know, this is such a tricky thing to write about. I can't imagine how difficult it would be. But even just from a practical point of view, it must be incredibly difficult to write about something from a place of loss without making the overall book just drenched in this kind of, you know, feeling of being utterly forlorn. And I think one of the things that really does exactly that sort of makes it more amusing, but also and more real and honest, but also conveys the intimacy and just that the preciousness of knowing someone is these many little descriptions where they're annoying each other and they know each other's habits and the sorts of conversations that you might have, which are, you know, come from just having this baggage, you know, which you might well want with another person, but having these years and years and years behind you both, which are then still acting on the present moment. And that again is kind of reinforced by this non-linear structure. It's great. It's beautifully done. There's no point in this book where I felt overwhelmed, which is a tricky thing to do. I also feel like as a reader, I can be quite sensitive to these sorts of books, but it was so real and it felt so deeply coming from a place of honesty, which makes it all the more interesting that it's autofiction, because it felt very, very true. It felt like it spoke to a lot of fundamental truths about long friendships and about the nature of depression too.
So tell me more about the structure that you just mentioned as being non-linear. Like, how is it constructed? What is the architecture?
Some of it is, because it begins with her saying, I go to see my friend and I can't get her, you know, I need to get her to leave the house. So some of it is, there's a sort of spine.
So there's a contemporary storyline that goes along.
Yes, and that is the last months, weeks, days of her life as well. And then in between, we're going in and out of their history together. I mean, how would you describe that fragmented but somehow very carefully made structure, Hannah?
I would probably describe it as a series of vignettes. I mentioned earlier too that the book is self-aware. So, and when I say that, what I mean is that we get these glimpses, or the narrator admits us into the process of creating the book we are now reading. And sometimes that's done directly when she's saying, you know, I don't have the quote in front of me, but she's sort of saying, I was working on something else and then I'd never meant to write this book, but it insisted sort of upon itself. But also indirectly, towards the front, I think it's only on page 9 or something, she says, as a writer, I had long understood the protean nature of the beginning, how there were 3 or maybe 13 ways into a short story. And all these little commentaries about writing and what it is to be a writer inform its, you know, we feel as a reader are being informed about the nature of how this book came into being itself. So it's not only reflective, but it's kind of reflexive as well in a way, which I think is really interesting. Because this is also, in many ways, a book about what it means to write and what it means to develop a friendship in art and in writing. And I really loved those elements of it too. I actually think that's a very important part of it. When I say that it's a portrait of a friendship, I think it's quite distinctly a portrait of the friend within the context of being her writer and the friendship, as focused through the lens of their own relationship to one another as artists.
Just, I'll make the observation, I'm just intrigued hearing Hannah talk about it, because if you think about Deborah's work and Gabrielle's body of work as well, they have been in constant conversation with the women writers of the previous 150 years in Australia individually. And this is a continuation in a way of that conversation. If you think about Deborah Adlaide's A Bright and Fiery Troop, which is a book I loved and I've always loved, and as a history of Australian women writers, but even the Carey Elizabeth von Arnim searching novel, these two writers have both in a way been searching for other voices of women writing Australian identity throughout their careers, and now they've in a way found their way back to each other. It sounds very beautiful.
And they do it by talking, they often talk about reading and they talk about the act of writing, but what they don't do is read each other's work and analyze it. So there's something very active about their reading and writing selves without then having to confront what the other is doing in a way. And there's something quite careful there about the boundaries that they're making with each other, even though there are other things that they're doing in parallel. So they had both worked in universities, but they did it in different ways. I mean, Deborah just kept on working, whereas, or the narrator, Deborah, and her friend kept moving in and out of the academy and was always haunted by a fear of failure, anxieties about money, fear about, you know, being an older woman in poverty. So the way that they managed their working lives and their anxieties about that were fundamentally different, but they kept talking about all of that over and over again. And managing somebody else's depression and anxiety, that is a really tough thing to read about, Hannah, isn't it?
Mm, it really is. And I think there was one line which I think really speaks to the heart of the book, where the narrator says, "And then I realized the worst irony of all, the greatest from the universe, the biggest glob of ibis shit. Words were our life, but they could not save a life." And I think much of this book is the narrator realizing the things that have saved her are not available to her friend. Yeah. And there's a great poignancy, I think, in that realization which has developed over the course of the book.
It's also really worth listening to an interview on The Book Show on ABC Radio National with Claire Nichols. It's a very good discussion of the making of this book.
Well, it could be good to listen to it in preparation to read it, sounds like. Well, okay, looks like it's pretty good. When I Am 64 by Deborah Adelaide. This is ABC Radio National's The Bookshelf on ABC Listen or via your good old radio. I'm Cassie McCullough. With me, as always, is Kate Evans and our reviewers today, Tom Wright and Hannah Kent. Now, it's time to talk about the Trojan War, which is really a sentence you might like to hear in a C.S. Lewis novel. But it's true. We're talking about the Iliad and why we keep revisiting these stories of, well, are they fiction? Are they history? On stage, on screen, why is it so rich with meaning for us still today?
Before we get to this latest iteration, Tom Wright, why do you think this 10-year-long war still has such resonance?
Well, the Iliad is, you know, one of the foundation texts of whatever this contested space is that's called the Western canon, and it still remains a extraordinary poem of the way in which an outside entity can land on your doorstep and throw everything, your gods, your crops, your children, the air you breathe, everything can be brought asunder. War is a constant theme, and it can be a metaphorical war or it can be a literal war, but whatever it is, it's an eternal background to the songs that human beings sing each other. And the Iliad sets so many of the templates by which we come to understand the nature of outsiders, the nature of insiders, the sometimes inscrutable nature of the gods. It just sets things up. And then Troy itself is of enormous significance, particularly for Australians, as a society that has historically, for the best part of 100 years, told itself, our foundation myth is a group of foreigners invading a beach on the Hellespont. Does that sound familiar? 4,000 years ago, it was the same thing. I'm talking, of course, about Anzac Cove. War, human beings, and the Song of Arms. Not necessarily fashionable stories, particularly in times of peace, but my goodness, it's an unkillable set of stories.
Sure is. I remember we were just reading, doesn't seem like that long ago, but it was probably about 5 years ago more, Pat Barker's reinvestigation of the Trojan War and how she... Well, actually, we had a bit of a disagreement about it, Kate, didn't we? Because I said, why has she made these boring lives of all these women the foreground when, in fact, there's this extraordinary, really gung-ho story?
But these are images that come from our subconscious, aren't they? You know, the Trojan horse, beware of Greeks bearing gifts, you know, don't look a gift horse in the mouth. We're constantly, even in our colloquial language, evoking these stories. Some are mythic, some are about kings and princes and warriors and the manly deeds of warriors such as Achilles and Hector, but there are other stories implicitly present inside what seems to be an epic poem of war.
Mm. And that's where I actually thought that Pat Barker's version of the women's story was interesting. And
yeah, but can I just to clear my name, what I was saying was the sweeping of tents and the, you know, moving of urns was nowhere near as interesting as that love affair between Patroclus and yes. Achilles.
But there's so many things you can then do with these named heroes and the people who are ostensibly the hero of the stories if you decide to play around with it. And that's what Jan Martel has done in this latest novel of his, Son of Nobody. Now, just to remind people, Jan Martel is the Canadian writer whose books include Life of Pi, which won the 2002 Man Booker Prize. He's also written Beatrice and Virgil, Self, and The High Mountains of Portugal. So here's somebody who also, I think, is very interested in fables and myths and fiction that's not necessarily realist. But what he's done with this one, Son of Nobody, is he's taken the idea of the Trojan War story, and what he's done on the page is something that mirrors what a lot of classical texts do. So if you read something like the Loeb edition of the Iliad or whatever, you have the epic poem in the top half of the page. You have a line in the middle of the page, and underneath you have very long and very detailed explanatory texts that become almost like a conversation between the top and the bottom of the page. And that's how he has set up this novel. At the top of the page, you have a new version of the Trojan War. And it's a new epic poem that supposedly has been found within the Oxyrhynchus papyrus. So I'm just going to pause there for a second and explain that this epic poem has been written and translated by another character who we meet on the page, which is a Canadian scholar, a PhD student. His name is Harlo Don. He's a classicist. He lives with his wife, Gail, and he's mostly, as a PhD student, he's mostly the at-home carer for their daughter, whose name is Helen. She's about eight. Mm-mm. And then he gets a one-year scholarship to head to Oxford to go to the Ashmolean Library and to do a sort of junior scholar's work on the Oxyrhynchus Papyrus, which is this extraordinary collection that because it was in the sands in Egypt.
Dry.
It's dry. So these fragments of all sorts of different texts have survived, and it is lifetimes and lifetimes worth of work to make sense
of
them.
It all together again, yes.
And finding out what's in there. So this then becomes, you know, it's that mode that we've all read so many times before, which is a supposed found manuscript story. This character says to his wife, well, look, I've got this scholarship in Oxford. Of course I have to go. And she says, well, I can't give up my career here. He says, well, I'm just going to go, and I'm going to go and study for a year. And at the airport, she whispers in his ear, don't come back. Their marriage is already rather fraught, but he absolutely adores his daughter. And a lot of this is supposedly addressed to her. So he goes and he meets a classical scholar overseeing this project who's like a tweedy older man from Central Casting.
Hang on. Getting Dan Brown vibes now.
Well, this is something that I think Jan Martel has to be very, very careful of, that it doesn't become a Da Vinci Code story, because there are elements of fantasy in it, in that anybody who's done any sorts of classical research knows that the amount of work you could get done in a year is not very much.
Yeah. But look, you know, most people know you can't be in a life raft with a giant cat either at sea. So, you know, that shouldn't be any boundary to him.
But, Kate, what's the difference between the epic that he uncovers in the sands of Oxyrhynchus from the one that we've got in our Penguin Classic editions? Is it a different form of the Trojan War?
Yes, it is, because what he comes across at first are just a few lines that have been repeated in these bits of papyrus. He can't work out at first whether it is about or by a character known as Sois. Muse, have you forgotten him? Sois was his name. And Sois is somebody who is telling a story but is described as the son of nobody. And at first, this scholar can't work out what that means. What does it mean to describe somebody as a son of nobody? Is it an insult And then as he goes on, what he realizes is that he has uncovered a new epic of the Trojan War that has been written from the perspective of an ordinary soldier. So it's not about the great heroes and leaders, although they appear in the story. It's all written from a muddier, bloodier, grittier perspective of the people who are rowing the ships, the people who are standing side by side in the phalanxes, the ones who are like the herd of small animals rather than like the heroic lions who rush in and do their violent work. So after setting up this process and the research and the fragmentary stuff, then we actually get above the line on this page an entire epic written in the form of an epic. Now, this makes for quite intense reading, and it does go in and out of the story that we know of the Iliad. So we sort of need the story that's happening in the bottom half of the page as well. We need to keep going back to this fairly difficult, self-obsessed scholar who has neglected his family in Canada and who is also not paying attention to what the senior academics in Oxford want him to do. We need to go in and out of his story almost as a relief from the intensity of this new epic. But what he does that's quite compelling is that he'll pick up on individual lines and take them apart. I mean, of course, this is all a fiction. So he's taking apart a fictional line in a fictional new epic. But I think it's quite clever.
But listen, Kate, I'm going to put the challenge to you. Why wouldn't I just go out and get an annotated version of what we know about the Oxyrhynchus papyrus and learn all about it? Why would I read Jan Martel's version, which may or may not be based on an interpretation or willfully fictitious?
Well, because the Oxyrhynchus papyrus will give you all of those things that drive you a bit nuts, which is it will give you shopping lists and it will give you very fragmented details of everyday life, whereas what he's doing here is giving you another grand narrative. And if you like a grand narrative, you're getting one that will sit beside the Iliad and the Odyssey rather than sitting beside something else. Well, so, I mean, it gives you a story.
I don't mind a shopping list. I found a shopping list in a trolley at one of the big supermarkets once, and it was typed on an old-fashioned typewriter and it said, meat, bread, lotto. Now, if that's not a goddamn start for a book, I don't know what is. Okay, well, it gets a thumbs up. Jan Martel's version of the Iliad, as reviewed for us by Kate Evans. It's called Son of Nobody.
But if you're a classicist, don't think, or if you want to be a classicist, don't think you're going to get your work done as quickly or as neatly as this, because you won't.
All right, well, let's get some reading recommendations before we part company. Hannah Kent, first to you.
Well, I have actually been thinking a lot this year about how I don't reread anymore. I feel like that's, you know, a wonderful problem to have so many new books that you're always picking up something fresh. But I was thinking, actually, talking about, you know, retelling history through a queer lens, I was thinking back to a lot of the books that I really enjoyed and the first ones that I encountered which had done this. And one of those was Tipping the Velvet by Sarah Waters, which I remember as being, you know, a fantastic read. It kind of blew my socks off way back in 2008 when I read it. And I was thinking, you know, that would just be such a fun book to return to so many years on. And I loved it. I actually listened to the audiobook and it remains an absolute romp. Really, really enjoyable. So that's what I've been doing. And I'm so glad I did, because it is nice to make time to return to books. I think, you know, almost two decades after I initially read that one as well, and to read it from a slightly different perspective. So that's what I've been doing. And the other books that I want to return to are the other ones that I read at that sort of very pivotal moment in my life when I was studying creative writing at university. I really want to read Delia Falconer again. So she's next on my list. She's a wonderful Australian novelist and fantastic creative writing teacher. And I remember reading her and it flipped a switch in my head. It made me really start to reconsider the way I was going to approach prose, particularly, you know, how I was going to craft lyrical prose. So that's what I've got planned.
Mm. The Service of Clouds, is that the novel of hers you're going to return to?
That's one of them. I also really loved The Lost Thoughts of Soldiers, which was quite extraordinary. Very brief, but very beautiful.
And she wrote that beautiful little book about Sydney, which I often think of as I'm walking the streets. Yeah. Okay. Well, in praise of rereading, what about you, Tom Wright? What have you been reading lately?
Oh, it's wonderful to hear Tipping the Velvet mentioned again. I like that too. I like the way it moves along. It's just got a nice pace to it because I'm one who gets frustrated when books take too long, whereas that one just is, it knows how to gear itself. I've been reading, of all things, Peter Cornell, the Swedish writer's 1987 book, The Ways of Paradise. And I've been holding my tongue as we've been talking about the Jan Matel book because this is exactly that. This is a imagined set of footnotes to a text that we never see. So instead of having the epic on at the top half of the page and the notes down below, we only get the notes. So it's an elaborate conceit. We don't actually know what the history is. We don't even know what the subject of the book is. We have to piece it all together from the footnotes. Sometimes these footnotes are just 47, it was pink. And then 48 might be an elaborate discursive essay on the nature of the scapegoat in the Bible. And then note 49 might be picking up on that theme obliquely, but talking about the nature of sacrifice in ancient Hindu practices, etc., etc. It's an almanac. It's a discursive set of ruminations upon conspiracy theories, on time, on exploration, on suppressed manuscripts. It's everything a postmodernist absolutely loves, all in the one book. This is a cult book in Sweden and very loved in France, but it's taken a long time for it to sort of reach into the English-speaking world. So if you're a lover of Borges and Borges's inheritors and heirs, then Peter Cornell's 1987 The Ways of Paradise. I enjoyed it immensely, and I'm a smarter person from having read it too. Gosh,
well, that's terrifying.
And that's possibly another book that's with as a found manuscript that's in conversation with Nabokov's Pale Fire from
Very
1962.
Much so, yes. It has that aspect as well.
Which also had a supposed lost great poem and long notes as well.
And an unreliable narrator / editor.
Look, I wonder if we've got time for me to tell you all about one other new release while we're on the, you know, building up our book list thing.
Yeah,
what do you reckon,
yeah.
Cassie?
Do it.
It's by Ingrid Horrocks. It's called All Her Lives, Nine Stories. And one of the reasons I was drawn to this is that we've had such a run of short stories over the last few weeks here on the bookshelf. We talked about Lauren Groff's latest, Louise Erdrich's, and I noticed Colm Tabin has a new collection of short stories, The News from Dublin, out this week. But this one by Ingrid Horrocks, she's a New Zealand writer, and all of her stories present pivotal moments in the lives of women across different time frames. And the opening story has a woman returning to New Zealand in 1919, having worked as a nurse in France, and the whole world had opened up to her in all its blood and tragedy, and now she's back on the farm. And as familiar as a story like that is, there was something different about reading it from a New Zealand perspective, and that's one of the things that I've enjoyed about this book, is that it just takes us into the New Zealand landscape and storytelling in a way that sort of reminds me of both what we share and what's unfamiliar with New Zealand stories and why, of course, we should be reading them. And so that's Ingrid Horrocks' All Her Lives, published by UQP.
Okay, well, what a rich selection of books we have picked over like a little tray of chocolates today. Thank you both, Hannah and Tom. It's always a pleasure talking books with you.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you, Cassie. Thank you, Kate. Thank you, Hannah.
Tom Wright is a theatre writer and artistic associate at the Belvoir Street Theatre in Sydney. And Hannah Kent is a novelist, scriptwriter and memoirist whose latest book is Always Home, Always Homesick.
Next time on the bookshelf, Ben Lerner's transcription. I'm a little bit anxious that one's awaiting me because the last one was insanely hard to penetrate, but brilliant. at the same time. I mean, he is one of the great writers of the age in the US. Also, Steve Toltz, A Rising of the Lights, Shant Hughes, No Such Thing as Monday, there is here at Radio National, but also some Irish crime fiction, Kate's favourite, Tana French's The Keeper.
Looking forward to all of that next time. I'm Kate Evans.
I'm Cassie McCullough. See you then.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.